Let me welcome everybody. And we have a very special speaker today, Frank Mueller from the Netherlands. I'll introduce him in just a moment, but let me just let people know the format of today's presentation. So I will conduct a formal interview for the first 45 or 50 minutes, and then I'll open up the lines and participants can ask their own questions for Frank Mueller. So it's my real pleasure to introduce and welcome Frank Mueller to our teleconference series. I had the very nice opportunity to meet Frank this last year. I was teaching in the Netherlands, and I actually taught at his school in Meppels, Netherlands. And I can honestly say that within 10 minutes of meeting the gentleman, I felt like I had met a long-lost brother. We had so much to share. I think we just started talking, and from the moment that I met him to the moment that I left, we just simply could not stop speaking about all kinds of different subjects. And I'm very excited to go back, actually, and pick up our conversation. So Frank was born in Rotterdam, Netherlands, and he has been the director of the J.T. Kent College in the Netherlands since the year 2000. His father and grandfather were both classical musicians, and music has been a very important factor in Frank's life. Actually, one of his first interests was in pop music at the age of 11. Frank was introduced to homeopathy after he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and after 5 years of working with homeopathy, basically he was cured that and the use of, I guess, music therapy. He began his formal training as a homeopath, and then since 1990 he's been practicing as a homeopath, music therapist, and psychotherapist with a special emphasis on homeopathy. He's also taught music and biology at a Steiner Secondary School before he was asked to teach anatomy and physiology at the J.T. Kent College in Meppels. And Frank has also written a number of books and articles in Dutch, including a book on the Composite family of remedies and another book on case-taking. In addition to his involvement in homeopathy, Frank has interests in spirituality, music, Rosicrucianism, Sufism, Zen Buddhism, anthroposophy, flamenco dancing, Indian tabla, et cetera, et cetera, many other very interesting pursuits. So this is a kind of a Renaissance man who we're very fortunate to have for 1 hour on a Sunday morning. So first of all, Frank, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. We really appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Ah, our pleasure. So I wanted just to start, we know that you wrote this book on the composites.
Yes.
And I thought perhaps you could just give us a little bit of a background, like how you decided to write this book, you know, what prompted you to choose the composite, and just kind of a little bit of background on how this came to be, basically.
Okay. That's good. Let me first say that English is not my mother tongue, so I perhaps have a different pronunciation. Please correct me if I do not pronounce things right. We started to write in the book just after 2000 when I joined the Kent College, because we discovered that a lot of Materia Medica is, it's boring often, but the connection between plants and remedies are not often made in Materia Medica. So we started to write for our students, and after a couple of years, we had gained so much, we had so much material that we decided to make it a book. And just because we had been busy with the composite for a very long time and very intensive, we decided to write that first, and we're now busy with the book about the Solanacea.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you're doing another one now in Solanacea.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The nightshades.
Great. Now, I know that Jan Scholten and some other practitioners have talked a little bit about the composition of the soil affecting the remedy, and I think there's something that you've talked about that in your book as well. Could you elaborate a little bit about?
Well, I didn't get that completely.
Yeah.
What do you want, about the plant family or about the remedy family?
Well, no, my understanding is that you've written a little bit about the composition of the soil or the minerals of the various plants having an effect. Like
Yes. I did that.
Yeah.
Well, we did an investigation on that and to find out what are the common themes in the plants, and then we said, well, we first have to look at the family, and we've, for instance, discovered that the most of the composite where is made remedies of are growing on silica-rich soil. They all need a high level of silica in the soil to develop well. Mm. And there's actually two main remedies which don't have that, but they have also a different picture in the homeopathy. So we found a correlation between the soil they're growing on, the way they grow, and the pictures. And the two that do not need silica soil, but actually calcareous soil, is that how you pronounce it in English? Calcarea?
Calcarea, yeah.
Calcarea. They need calcareous soil, and that's Quina and Chamomilla. Hmm. They need another soil to develop. Hmm. And they have both a different picture also, and the plants grow on a different way.
Hmm.
And that's a very interesting thing that we found out. So we looked at plants that way. And the other way we looked was that you can see in the whole family that there's two, the characteristic of the composite, that you have two different flowers. You have the leaflet flowers and you have the tube-shaped flowers. And the plants have fertilized from the tube-shaped flowers are different from the plants that fertilize from the leaf-shaped flowers. So, for instance, Taraxacum flowers on the leaf shapes, and for instance, Helianthus, the sunflower, fertilized from the tube flowers, and all the tube flowers, fertilizing plants, make oils. And the flower fertilizers make milk juice. Like when you cut off lettuce, then you find this milky colored liquid coming from the lettuce. And that's a lettuce. There's a leaf flower plant in the composite as well. And there's two different groups of plants, and they act different on the human constitution.
Hmm. I want to ask you about that in just one second, Franck, but before I do that, I just want to, for people who maybe are not that familiar with the terminology, Franck is talking about a botanical family called the Compositae and the members of this family, which he has written a book about, and various categories within the Compositae grouping. Compositae include remedies like arnica and chamomilla and helianthus, sunflower, and Bellis perennis and remedies like that. It's called the daisy family. So,
yeah, Eupatorium. Eupatorium is one of them too.
I'm sorry, say it again?
Eupatorium.
Eupatorium.
Eupatorium,
yeah.
Perfiliata.
Absolutely, Eupatorium, Echinacea. There's many dahlias, many other members. Actually, I think it's the second largest of the botanical families in nature. But so getting back to this thing about the differences between the different types of flowers, in terms of medicinal effects, what did you discover in terms of these different types of flowers?
What do you mean by that? I don't get that.
You said that there were two different basic types of flowers in the Compositae. I'm curious.
Yes.
Did you find that
yes.
There were different qualities in their medicinal properties based on these different qualities, or there was...
Color hung up. Please enter your destination number now.
Hello? Hold on, everybody. Sorry, I lost the... I lost Franck. One second.
Please enter your...
Yes.
Franck, sorry about that. I don't know what happened, but...
No, I don't know either.
In any case, so my question was, you were describing two different types of Compositae flowers, and I'm curious.
Yes.
Did you find that there were differences in their effects as medicines based on these?
Yes. Yes.
You
yes,
did.
There are differences. Yes. Let's say the type of plants within the group where the disc flowers, the tubular flowers making oil, like sunflower, like anida, like calendula, all these oil plants, they are often used like calendula for the skin, for instance. They are very well to human. You can eat them like the sunflower. There's a lot of difference in that. While all the milk, the poisonous plants you find in the family are all in the milky juice part. So there's the other hand. Yes, you have poisonous lettuce, which is one of the most poisonous compositae, which is one of those milk plants. So you see there's a lot of difference between the two group of plants, and you can look to that as remedies as well and see that there's a lot of difference.
Very interesting. Frank, yeah. I'd like to actually ask you about some specific remedies and specific examples from the compositae, but before I do that, I thought maybe just in general, you know, when you write a book like this, it's inevitable that you're going to learn a lot of very interesting things. I'm curious, what did you guys learn in preparing and publishing this book?
We discovered that we have a lot of beautiful treasures in this plant family that we've forgotten about. And the old school homeopaths, namely in America, used some of these remedies very often, and now they have gone from our practices. So there's, for instance, a remedy like Cardus Marianus, which we found in the old literature. It was a tremendous remedy for gallbladder stones, and we didn't know that. We did know we had read it, but when we went into it, we discovered it. And while writing the book, which cost us 2 years, I had some patients with gallbladder stones. I thought, well, let's try, and had some tremendous cures. So there's little jewels in this composite group that we discovered. And that's one of the things that we learned. And we learned that there is indeed, when you look to the provings and you look to the clinical experience, there are central themes in the plant family.
So since you mentioned that, I know for the compositae, one of the ideas is the idea of trauma.
Yes.
Can you elaborate, can you tell us a little bit about what you discovered in terms of trauma and any other ideas that seem to run through the compositae?
Yes. Well, the trauma is, of course, the main aspect of most of the plants in the compositae family. But there's a variation of traumas, and it can look and see completely different as what we normally see as a trauma. What Arnica is, of course, the most well-known example of trauma. And when we think about Arnica, when somebody falls down and bumps on his head. But what a lot of people don't know is that, for instance, Arnica is a tremendous remedy for whooping cough. And we have wondered, while we were busy with it, why acts it so strong on a whooping cough situation? But when you look to a child having whooping cough, and he's really on the high point of the disease, he's coughing and coughing and coughing and vomiting, and then you see actually the child is excrenating. He's getting out of his body because he doesn't get enough breath anymore, and hey, he's suffocating in the vomiting. And that's actually a kind of trauma that you see that runs through the remedy Arnica, but you can find it on different places in the plant family as well, that every plant has its own variation of a trauma, and that can be psychic or emotional, and it can be pure physical, and there's a lot of differences in that. We did, for instance, a proving with Bellis perennis, which is in the old school known as a remedy for ground workers who go over the border. They work too long and too hard and then get a backache and they can't go up and down, and they do as if they don't have any hurt and just continue on working, keep on smiling. And it's like the daisy. It's mown off and the next day it's in the grass again like there's nothing happened. And when we did the proving, we had the coincidence that from the 30 provers we had, there were 12 or 13 with a past of sexual abuse. And the remedy acted very deeply on these people. Because a lot of these women, what they do as if there's nothing happened, but they bear inside a deep trauma of this sexual abuse. And the Bellis perennis happened to be a wonderful remedy to help them to cure from these injuries. So that's two variations on the trauma thema of the compositae, and all the compositae have that on their own way.
Frank, that's very exciting, because for me personally, when I have gone back and looked at the original Materia Medica of Arnica and Bellus Prenison and the original provings of both those remedies, I've oftentimes found it difficult to know in certain circumstances which of those to prescribe. There's so many similarities between those two remedies, and it's very exciting to have these subtle differentiations brought out. I'm curious. I know your book now is only available in Dutch. Are there plans to publish it in English at all? Or?
Yes, we love to publish in English, but this is a 700-page book, and we have to find somebody who is able to help us to translate it. Because
700 pages.
700 pages.
That's a lot of work.
it's 69 remedies. So
that's something that would be invaluable to have for the English-speaking homeopathic community, because just even what you just said now in terms of Bell's Prentice, that's going to be an invaluable piece of clinical information for the for practitioners to have.
Yes. And there's some other beautiful things in it. But for instance, we discovered with a remedy that very little people know is espalacia. And espalacia was proven in France and then translated into German. And in the German, they brought it into the repertory. But in these translations, there were made a lot of mistakes. So espalacia is actually wrong in the repertory. And there's some important symptoms of the remedy were not translated at all and didn't come into the repertory also. So we rebuild the remedy picture in the book from the original provings again.
Mm.
So that you get a completely different insight into what the remedy is.
Mm-hmm. And have you had a chance to prescribe it, or just?
Yes, only a couple of months ago, I had a patient where I was puzzling. So often, as we all know, we have to puzzle on our patients. Not everybody is presenting beautiful Materia Medica book pictures to the homeopath.
We got to train our patients better, you know. We got to train our patients better.
Yes, we have to.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I had the coincidence that I could prescribe the remedy with a great success, because the patient came with me with a very unpronounced a collection of symptoms, but one of the things that brought me to espalacia is that she had an aversion to milk. She couldn't stand milk, and then you think it's calcium carbonic and things like that, and we prescribed it and we didn't it, and she had a pain around the heart with a very strange ameliorated by physical activity. As a lot of people with heart complaints, they aggravate by physical exercising. And she had a burning pain on the chest, and that ameliorated by walking, by working in the garden, doing the laundry, whatever. And when I continued talking with her, that was a kind of a main element in her complaints, that physical exercise ameliorated, and that brought me to espalacia, and with great success, because her chest pain disappeared. So that's a funny things, and writing a book like that brings you into that kind of small symptoms.
Mm. Very interesting. What about Waithia? Did you find anything interesting about that remedy?
About espalacia?
No, about Waithia.
Waithia, yes. Waithia is a very beautiful plant. You know it in California, don't you?
Yeah,
it grows there.
Yeah. But we don't know it that well as a remedy, really. We just have a few interesting, strange rare peculiars, but we don't really have a good picture of it. So I'm curious if you were able to really bring that remedy out.
Yeah, well, no, that was difficult because there was very little symptoms and it was very hard to find a consistent picture of the remedy. And actually we said, well, there should be done a next proving to that. There is not enough. What we have seen in the picture is that it's mainly a hay fever picture.
Right.
That's the main way to describe it. I've seen it several times after I learned it. It was one of the first remedies I went into. This very peculiar itching at the palate in the mouth,
right,
and in the throat, which is very very into the center of the remedy as far as we can see. The mind picture we could not find much about. And the patients, I've been prescribing it, I think, to 20 or 30 patients in meanwhile, because the book is written already 3 years ago. I don't get a clear mind picture from that. And perhaps it isn't there. Some remedies don't have these typical mind things. It's what I see, it's most of the time it's people who are fit into the psoriatic miasm and don't have a very severe fear picture. They have some fear in mind, but it is not very pronounced. They have a kind of a discomfort, but not more than that. So I cannot extend the mind picture there. And say, well, Wiatia, think about Wiatia when you have hay fever patients. And I think that's the main way to describe it.
Sure. And what about some of the more common remedies like chamomilla? Did you discover anything interesting or new about chamomilla, for example?
I don't know if it's new. There's written a lot about chamomilla, of course, and it's not for nothing. It's one of our main remedies. The way we look to it when we went into the original provings, what we often do as good as we can, when we can find them, we go reading the original provings. There's not much done proving on chamomilla, actually. It's two by Hahnemann and five persons in 1844 somewhere in Austria, and then another two of another place, and there's not much modern provings. But what we found as idea in chamomilla, as we pronounce it in Holland, is that it's in its what do you call it in English? Their natural sensibility is that they are actually people with a very alive nerve system, and they are very sensitive to all kinds of things. So it's very sensitive persons. And we see a lot of things in common with Kina when we look to the picture. And they are physical sensitive, but also emotional sensitive. And they're often people who are very susceptible to art. It's people who love art, but that it has to be refined on a certain way. And that's not the picture that we normally have from somebody who's in chamomilla, who's angry and who's smashing with the things. But before they get into pathology, they are actually very friendly and sensitive people. And because of this sensitiveness, their nerve system is very easily provoked. So that can be sounds. They're very sensitive to sounds, and but also to pain. That's what we, of course, know chamomilla. They get aroused by pain, and then that's one of their main causes why they get into the remedy picture, is that they have some pain and they just can't stand it. And the aesthetical sensitiveness, that's what I would like to call it, is then so that they can't stand it and then get into the picture we know from people who are complaining about their pains. Get very aggressive. Everything hurts them, and they have a fear of being touched, which is one of the things that runs through the composite as symptom also. There's a lot of remedies that don't want to be touched. And by chamomilla, it's because they are so sensitive and they already have pain, and they don't want more impulses to feel their body because they're already so overexcited. And then they get restless and they get nasty to people, and they want something, and they want to do want something else, and you get into the tuberculin miasm, and so on. That's the main picture that we found from chamomilla. And, yeah, of course, we see that a lot with children.
Sure, sure. So as you're, you know, as you're talking, Frank, and I'm listening to you, I can tell that you spent a lot of time studying the provings of these various remedies. Just in general, what was your method for creating this book? What approach do you use to describe the remedies?
We walked, I wrote it together with a colleague, and we walked a two-track path. I am the one who has the connection with the plants. So I went into the plants, see where do they origin from, what in the soil they need, how they grow, how they... we describe the plant picture extensively. And from looking at the plant at one side and what kind of chemicals are in it and how is it used in herb medicine, and then we went to the known remedy picture. And if it's there. If it wasn't there, then we went into all the corners we could find in homeopathic materia medica to see what we could find about the remedies. And then we looked, and we called it phenomenology. Are there correlations between the way the plant grows and the remedy picture we know? And then we went into the provings to see, can we find other things which are valuable, forgotten, overseen, perhaps misvalued. And then we started to rebuild the remedy picture from the provings and connect it what is well known about the remedy. And then always we went through what can we find in the symptoms known from the repertory, known from the materia medica, known from the proving, which we can say, well, that's the natural state of the person. We don't talk about pathology yet, but what's the sensitivity, the natural sensitivity, susceptibility, where can people be hurt easily? And then what are the causes, what brings up the symptoms, what brings up the pathology? And then we look for, well, what is after that, the psoric reaction, what is all psoric in the remedy picture, what's tuberculinic, what's psychotic, what's carcinotic, and what's syphilitic. And then you made a division in all the symptoms. And then you're going to see what the natural way of development is of somebody who is in his natural, his natural behavior is what is his starting point and where is he developing to? In within the same remedy picture, which stages are there? Mm. And like Hesku did in the cyclic way of thinking, we adapted that.
Mm. I want to ask you about that in just a second, because I know that you've used some of the work from Rajan Sankaran and also some of the work from Paul Hesku. But before I do that, I'm just curious, did you feel that from your study of the composites that you were able to identify themes that could be used in practice to differentiate? In other words, a person could come in and you could say, based on the qualities in this case, I'm pretty sure this is a composite, or you feel that that's not possible?
Yes, but of course not with all the cases, but yes. I've developed a kind of a sensitivity to composite patients. Not that I'm seeing them so very much, but Arnica and Bilis perennis, for instance, are actually very good representatives of the family. That one of the most important pronunciations of an Arnica patient is, "Let me alone. There's nothing wrong with me." You see that he has has a severe blow, he has a confusion, and he says, "There's nothing wrong with me." And that's actually a theme that goes for all the patients. There's some of course, like chamomilla, which goes a little bit beside, but most of the remedies have this attitude on a certain way, that they do as if there's nothing there, and they don't want to be helped, and they don't want to be touched, but you can see there's something wrong. And like Bayliss, he's able to cover it up. but there's like Apatorium, like Arnica, is not able to cover it up. But Apatorium also says, well, I'm very hurt, but let me, it will go all right, and you don't have to help me. And that's something that's in the attitude of the composite patients.
Interesting.
And yeah, that's what I see. For instance, with either Grindelia patient who said that literally, he said, "Well, it's all right. I manage. Nothing wrong with me. Let me." And that's very opposite to sitting at the desk of a homeopath and say, "There's nothing wrong with me."
Mm. Very interesting.
it's incongruent.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, well, that's fascinating. And so let's get back to what you were talking about. You've been mentioning a lot about miasms, and
yes.
I'd like you to just I know we don't have a great deal of time here, but if you could just explain the approach you're using. I know that you're using some of the ideas, the core delusion ideas from Sankaran's method.
Yes,
Of the Paul Hirschke's ideas in terms of his cycles and segments.
Yes.
And also I know that you use the miasms in your model. Could you explain the approach that you use in your school?
Yes, because it's not only in the Materia Medica, it is also in our method of analysis. The idea is, like Paul Hirschke pronounces in his Cycles and Segments, that people develop in their pathology over the time. And they develop within the remedy picture. They can go from the one picture to the other. That's all known to us. But some people go circle after circle within the same remedy. And we use that approach. And we said, well, there's a natural sensibility in every remedy picture. You can see in every good proving that people produce symptoms that tells you what the natural sensibility of the remedy is. And then you can see that they are sensitive to certain causa. Every remedy has its own causa. For instance, we're a bit busy with the nightshades now, which is far much more in the front of my thinking because I'm busy writing on that. From belladonna, the belladonna plant grows in the shade of a lot of other plants. That's what he likes. And when this tree, for instance, disappears, then the belladonna plant disappears and comes up a few meters further away where a shade again. So he tries not to get into the full sun. And you see in the belladonna remedy picture that the patient aggravates from sunlight. So we found these kind of things in the compositae also, that there's certain susceptibility, or what a horrible word in English.
it's a very good job. Perfect.
That is sensitiveness to certain causas, and every remedy has its own causa, and that provokes the core delusion. That provokes the state of being, as Sankaran calls it in the first book. For instance, the Arnica patient get a blow, and he says, there's nothing wrong with me. And he really believes it. His delusion is, there's nothing wrong with me, but I have to take care that I will not again get a blow. And then he comes into a compensation state, and that's where actually the miasms start. He experiences a kind of shortness, a kind of not being protected. And that brings the patient into the psoriatic state. And you can see that in every case that's there, every case you can see that is lack of protection or lack or something from something else and brings the patient into a fear, which is very psoriatic state. And there starts pathology. And if he is not cured, not helped, on one way with therapy or with homeopathic remedy or whatever, and he stays for some time in this psoriatic state, then his compensations go run short, and then he try to find a different answer to his feeling of fear, to his shortness, to his unprotectedness, and then he goes into the tuberculinic state, where he runs around about, trying to escape from his fears and trying most extreme things to find something else. And it's beautiful described, for instance, in the book of Thomas Mann, the Magic Mountain, is it called in English?
Sure.
Zauberberg in Deutsch?
Yeah, yeah.
In German, yeah. Magic Mountain, where you can see that somebody escapes from reality. And that's very typical in a state. But, well, at the end, that doesn't help you too. So then you go to the next stage. You come into the psychotic state where people get more aggressive to protect themselves. Where in tuberculinum it's still fits of anger, then there's a common sort of constitutional aggression into the psychotic picture, and people go for extremes to find a solution for their needs. Well, at last they won't get there, and then they develop on further on, and they go inwards, and they come into the carcinotic picture and going to blame themselves and feel guilty, trying to try to please everybody, and so on and so on, and end at last in the syphilitic state, where they deny that there's something wrong, and then deny that they have an illness or that they have hurt somebody, and then their pathology goes to destruct themselves. And even then, if people get out of there, they come back into a next level of psoric pathology. And then you see that they run the circle again. So that's the way we do it in our school, to learn to teach, the students to learn to look at that.
Let me just try to get a little bit of clarification, Frank. So basically, you describe a remedy as a cycle, moving from one state to another. And then each of the segments within the cycle represent a different miasmatic quality. Is that correct?
Yeah, a miasmatic state. Yes.
So each of the segments represents a miasmatic state. So depending within the cycle, the remedy, you could be producing more psoric or psychotic or syphilitic type.
Yes.
I got it.
Yeah. And what you see in remedies, we put it in the book as that way. Yeah? We made a sort of small picture in a circle, really presented graphically in a picture, where you can see which are the stages of the remedy within this cycle of miasms. And then you see that every remedy has a heavy point in one of the miasms.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So in other words, each remedy has an emphasis within a particular miasm, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah, one or two, but
and so
mostly one.
Those qualities. And of course, within a particular patient, you might have one, like for example, one agaricus patient who might be more tubercular and another one which might be more psoric. Is that correct?
Yes, and both can need the same remedy.
And they can use the same remedy. And what about using the nosodes? Do you use those as well in terms of your understanding of the miasms, or how does that work?
No, actually we're not. We make in our school, we make a strong emphasis on the difference between a nosode and the miasm. Although there is, of course, a strong connection between, let's say, metarhinum and the psychotic miasm, but they're not identical. They're different things. For the nosode is a remedy picture which is own development through the miasms.
Right.
You can do the same cycle with metarhinum as well.
Sure.
And the psychotic picture is larger than the nosode.
Right.
And when somebody is in a psychotic stage, you cannot say that he will need metarhinum.
Right, right. And Frank, do you use just four miasms, five miasms? How many miasms are you using?
Five.
Five, okay.
The three basic one from Hahnemann, and then the carcinotic from Fobister, and the tuberculinum. Who was that who brought it in?
Okay. I'm curious, have you looked at the other miasms that Sankran has put forward? And if so, why?
And the G?
Yeah, you know, the malaria, typhoid, and leprosy.
When we were studying on this and developing this system, we have been reading on Sankaran and on the Banerjee and on the Ortega and all those guys who wrote about the miasms. And we found that there's actually two main streams in homeopathy. And the Indian guys, funny enough, are on the stream that they have the belief that every microorganism can cause a miasm.
Right, right.
And we don't agree. This, because you would have an endless amount of miasms.
I've even seen, Frank, that things like heavy metals or chlorine could produce miasms. So you've got now hundreds and hundreds of miasms now out there.
Yes, but what we see is that a lot of these submiasms you have nowadays actually are variations on these five main miasms that have been discovered in the history of homeopathy. That's our point of view. That you can say a typhoid miasm, where you can see that it's somewhere in the tubercular psoriatic corner of the miasms, and that's a kind of a variation somewhere between it. So you can place them in these five, or somewhere in the circle of these five, and it doesn't add really something new, to my opinion.
Interesting. Frank, we only have a little bit of time before I want to open it up to let other people ask questions, but I thought perhaps you could just maybe give us a quick overview of a remedy that you've described in such a way so we could get a sense of, you know, the way that you would describe the actual process of a remedy. Is that possible? Could you do that in just 5 minutes or so?
Let me think about it.
Or is it just too much in such a short time?
Yeah, it's a very short time. Then we have to take a very well-known remedy. That would be making sense.
Yeah.
But then we move out of the composite. Then I have a very good example.
That's fine.
Then we take anacardium.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that's a very well-known remedy, and I hope everybody knows it's cashew nut.
Marking nut.
Marking nut, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's anacardium occidental, so one's the marking nut and one's the cashew nut.
Yes, okay. We're talking about, let me have a look, that I
think
it's right.
Oriental, marking nut, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, we call it cashew nut in Holland, but it's the Oriental.
Yeah,
that's what we're talking about. Yeah,
yeah.
So there's a very funny thing there that when you look to the fruit, the actually nut we eat is in a shell, is a double shell, and within this double shell there's an oil, and this oil is one of the most poisonous plant material we know. And it has a very marking phenomenon that when you get it onto your skin, it goes in there and it never goes away. It stays there like it has been engraved. Mm. And that's when we did the proving with that too, and we saw that was what people describe in the proving, that they have things happening in their life which are engraved into their soul. And what you see with these people is that there are people who need somebody to say to them, you did well, you did it good, it's, that you have done that well. That's what they need. That's their they are insecure. And they look for that. And that makes them depend on other people. They are sensible to authority. And what you see is that what brings them into the anacardium picture is they don't get this word, you have done well. This is good what you have done. They don't get it. They come to work under somebody who doesn't pay attention to that, who has not in his awareness that he has to do that with his employee. And so what they do, a healthy person would after some time say, well, have a good time the rest of your life, I go look for another job. But an anacardium doesn't. They stay. And they even work harder. And they try to do better so that the boss will say, you have done well. But it doesn't come. And they stay and they stay and they always go on and doubting themselves. Am I doing it right? Am I worth it? Will I ever get it? So there's the basic delusion is that they're not worth it, that they're not will ever get it. But they keep on trying their whole life. and they have fears that it will never come, and they keep on trying to get it, and they won't get it, because there's something in their attitude that nobody will notice them, that the boss will not see, that they produce all this effort to get the connection they want. And then after a long time, they get so far that they cannot express this inner tension, and then they get aggressive. And that's the picture that we know of an acardium. They get very aggressive and having impulses to stop somebody. But that's a long history before that, from effort to get this love, this attention they so hardly need. And then they get so off track that they get to do all kind of strange things to get this inner need fulfilled, so they can go into a very aggressive behavior, but also can go, for instance, into the psychomasochistic world to get pain done to themselves, also because they feel guilty and they want to be punished, and well, all kind of strange ideas. And then at last they get very violent, and their morality disappears. Well, is that the way of thinking that helps?
Great. That was very nicely done, Frank.
Okay.
Yeah, very nice description. Certainly fits my understanding of anacardium as well. So that was very, very lovely. Do you have anything you'd like to add about any of the other work that you're doing before I open it up and let other people ask questions? Is there anything? I know we'd like to have you come to North America and teach a seminar at some point. But aside from that, is there any other plans or anything you'd like to share that you guys are doing in your school?
Well, what should I say? We are very keen on the communicative part of human beings. We have very intense therapeutical training in the school, and I think that's very important to our profession in these times. Our patients get more complicated and get very disturbed sometimes, and so we need to be very keen on what signals our patients give verbally and non-verbally. And that's actually almost the half of my new book about taking the case, from how can you be aware of all the signals your patients gave and which ways he pronounces himself, what can help you to get to the essence of his problem. I think that's a very important thing in our time.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I know that I've heard, because I was there in the Netherlands a few months back, and I heard really very positive things from your students about your school. People seem to be very pleased with the education that they're receiving there. So that's the best testimony that you can get, basically.
Yeah, that's what I think. Yes, I'm very happy to hear that they...
that's what I heard from them, you know, but yeah. They're very pleased. So I'm going to, Frank, thank you so much. I'm going to open it up and let some other people ask some questions. Hold on one second.
Right.
Let me unmute the line. So does anybody have a question for Frank Mueller from the Netherlands?
Yeah, I have a question, Kim, but before that, how do you spell aspalasia, that remedy he was said for the burning thing around the heart?
Aspalasia. I tell you, it is ESPELETIA.
Okay, and my question is, the composite remedies are known for acute conditions, but have you used them for chronic conditions at all, and can you give an example?
Yes, I've used chamomilla for chronic treatment a lot. Kina, I've used it a lot for chronic cases. Let me have.
By the way, let me just clarify that you're talking about Cina, C-I-N-A.
No, C-I-N-A, yeah.
I'm thinking that you're talking about China Ficinalis, because some people...
No, Kina.
Yeah, I just want people to know that. Go ahead.
Yeah. And I recently used a small one for... Taraxacum. I sometimes used for chronic liver problems.
And that was, just so people know, that was Taraxacum, dandelion.
Okay, yeah, dandelion, yes.
Good. Anything else you want to say about that question, or should I move on to the next question?
Yeah, well, if the asker is content with the answer...
I think that was Alan who asked the question. Alan, is that are you satisfied, or did you have something else you needed to ask? Are you still there? Hi, everybody. Is there Alan? Is that satisfactory?
That was fine. That was excellent.
Okay, great. Other questions? Frank Mueller.
Kim?
Yes, please.
The call cut out on my end a couple of times, and I just wanted to clarify five miasms. He did toric, psychotic, syphilitic, and what else?
Toric, psychotic, syphilitic, tubercular, and the cancer miasms.
Okay, and then the remedy that he talked about with hay fever?
Wyethia.
Wyethia.
W-Y-E-T-H-I-A.
All right, W-Y...
E-T-H-I-A.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Other questions? You have an opportunity. You have a real renaissance man here who's been practicing homeopathy for 25 years and is a tremendous educator and practitioner. So there's a real opportunity here.
I have a comment or
sure,
sort of a question. I also do a lot of work with flower essence therapy. And I find that many of the things that you're talking about relate directly to the way people analyze conditions using flower essences for mental emotional problems. I would just say, would you think it would be a good combination to use your homeopathics as well as a flower essence in curing the disease?
I have not much experience with the Bach flower essences. I've been into it for some time, but it's not my thing. It doesn't come to me. And my wife has been working with it, and I've seen good results of it. But I know there's homeopaths who combine the things with success.
Mm-hmm.
So why not?
Yeah, he was called the second Hahnemann. So
yes, I know.
No, he
although
was
he wasn't
brilliant.
A homeopath.
Yeah, he was at one time.
No, he wasn't. He has been working with homeopaths together, but he's never been trained as a homeopath.
Oh, but when he made his nosos, didn't you say they were homeopathic? The Bach nosos, there are seven of them?
Yes, I know, yeah. It's a collaboration with Patterson. Patterson was a homeopath, though. He was trying to make an extension because he, as we all do, see that sometimes well-chosen remedies don't act. And the idea of the nosodes was quite new at that time. So that's where his bowel nosodes came from. And I must say, that's a very, very great addition to the homeopathy.
Yes, very good.
They're very worthful. You cannot use them with every patient, but some patients. I've had a psoriatic case which was really stuck. When with Morgan Gardner, it came into a beautiful development.
Excellent. I get that a lot with my clients. I have a quantum biofeedback machine, and often Morgan comes up on it. And I've never used the nosode on them, but I've been thinking of doing that.
Yes, yes. Especially for that kind of chronic cases with where the bowels are involved and skin problems, the bowel nosodes can be of great value to help your patient get cured from that.
Yes, thank you. And so many people are sick in the bowels, so, you know, it would be a wonderful...
Yes.
Thank you. I've just enjoyed this seminar so much.
Oh, good.
Okay.
we'll try to twist his arm and get him to come back again. But we still have about 3 or 4 minutes left, so if people have questions, here's your opportunity.
Fire up.
Go ahead.
Frank and Naga here from
yes.
New Jersey. Yeah, you told in the beginning that there are leaf-shaped flowers in this compositive family having poisonous latex. Could you give some examples of that?
Say the question again.
Yeah, I had a hard time understanding the question. Can you just say it one more time a little bit more slowly?
Yes, I couldn't get it either.
The poisonous element in these flowers, in the composite family, could you give some examples for that?
Okay. Yeah, I get it. There's not much poisonous flowers in this family. The poisonous lettuce is one of the examples. What should I say about it? There's not much, really much poisonousness in this family. In other families, it's much stronger than here. I couldn't make a good example of that besides poisonous lettuce.
Yeah, I guess, Frank, if you're looking at the Solanacea or the Umbelliferae, you're going to find a lot more poisonous members.
Yes, absolutely. Lochinacea also.
Oh, also much more poisonous, yeah.
Yes, but when you look to the nightshade family, then you find beautiful example of how poisonous plants act in human remedies. I can give you in botanical way an entrance that when you can see when a flower is flat, open, then the plant probably is not very much poisonous. But when the plant is making inside holes, like when you look to aconite, then you can see that the flower inside is making a hole, is making inner space. And actually, that's something that normally happens in animals. And when plants do that, they get poisonous.
That's very interesting. And that's true of digitalis, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. That's a phenomenological thing. And when you can see that with Conium maculatum is from the Umbellifera, but he makes the holes into the stem.
Mm.
And when he's very small and he doesn't have holes in the stem, he's not as poisonous. When he's grown up and these holes are very big, then he gets more poisonous. It's a very funny thing in plants.
I love it that you call them he or she. It gives it such a personal quality, and they are truly. The plant kingdom is just an extension of us, you know, our souls.
Perhaps it's the other way around.
Or vice versa, yeah. I thought of that too.
But yes, to me, every remedy. And also every plant as a group, eh? A plant is not an individual, but all the plants together are a being.
Yeah.
Like a remedy is a being.
Excellent.
Frank, I have another question.
Please go ahead.
What is your stance or take on doctrine of signatures vis-a-vis composite family?
Did you understand the question? He's asking about doctrine of signatures in relationship to the composites.
He's asking about what in relation to the composites.
What is your position on the doctrine of signatures?
Signatures.
Okay.
And
not
relationship to the composites.
Yeah. I'm not a signature man, although it perhaps sounds as if I am. But for me, a lot of connections made in signature are too simple. You cannot say that every yellow liquid will act on the liver. That's too easy. But there is a correlation between the way of plants living and growing and the symptoms they can cause as a homeopathic remedy. But you have to be very careful to make connections which are not found on not founded on a sound investigation. So I'm not a very great fan of signature.
That makes sense.
Yeah, we have to be careful.
Thanks.
We have just 1 minute left, so if somebody has one final question, please feel free to ask it.
I have a question on potency.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. So, for example, when using the remedy for the chronic liver, which one was that?
Ardus?
Taraxacum.
So if you have someone who's not jaundiced, but they have the swelling and, you know, the keynotes of Taraxacum, is it best to go with the 30C, or is there some other scenario that you should use?
Well, this is actually one of the most difficult subjects in homeopathy. Which potency do you take? It, for instance, makes for me a lot of difference how the life energy of the patient is. When he has a lot of power, then I could easily go for a higher potency when there's a low power, because when I provoke him too much, he gets into an aggravation and will not come out of it. So I look to the health state of the patient and try to see what can he have. And then I take a C30 or C2 or an LM potency, depending on how the health state of the patient is.
Right, and that's, some people will describe that as the strength of the vital force. So you're trying to get as close as possible to that resonation.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Well, that's just enough time to answer the last question. Frank, I want to thank you again. It was a very wonderful call, very informative, a lot of very useful, very interesting information. We hope you'll come back and do another one with us in the future. Everybody, please give Frank Mueller a big North American thank you for joining us on his... All right, thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, Frank, and thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.